Have you ever wanted to work in a flying ICU? Or maybe you're just passionate about saving lives. Right now you can realize your dream by applying to work for one of the best teams in the air medical industry. Air Methods is currently hiring qualified flight nurses, medics, and mechanics to join our air medical team. Check out our new salary and benefits packages. Visit airmethods.com/careers and apply today. That's airmethods.com/careers.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top. Located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Mikey V.
What is going on, my man?
How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. We survived the heat wave of the all-time hottest days ever in Oregon.
You know, first off, that sucks. That weather would even make a Texan sweat.
Yeah, it was not awesome, but thankfully I got the AC. It was a cool 68 degrees the whole time. Thankfully we didn't lose power. I know you guys know a little bit about that in Texas as well. We just hung out in the house. It was totally fine. But all my colleagues out there running calls, cardiac arrests on the sidewalk. Oh my gosh. Along with the highest temperatures ever, we also had the most calls we've ever had. I think we had over 300 calls in 24 hours. So,
oh my Lord.
Crazy. So, big props to all the peeps out there doing the dirty work out there.
Absolutely. You know, speaking, I don't know if you saw this, but I put some stuff up on the socials. As a Texan, every once in a while, you just got to go make the pilgrimage down to the Alamo. And I found myself staying at the historic Minger Hotel. You know how those irritating people from Ohio State always have to say the Ohio State?
The Community College of Ohio State?
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like that with the Minger. You just have to say the historic Minger Hotel.
Okay.
It's a really cool hotel and is literally across the street from the Alamo. So I could see the Alamo from where I was. And we were there for a conference. So we had our second annual Texas chapter of the NAMSP conference. It should have been our third, but you know, the situation got in the way. Yeah. And it was great seeing all of our colleagues back in person. Truly a wonderful thing. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, just to get into this pod, because I think it might be kind of a long one, to set this in context, we were there at the Minger, historic Minger, for our conference, and Dr. Casey Patrick and I did a lecture, and I said, this is just custom built for Lighthouse. It was a lecture on the 2020 LLSA article. So it's that time again. All of us board certified EMS physicians need to take this quiz, and we figured we'd go ahead and review the articles.
Well, and I had a question for you, because you know, I do a little artwork here and there for the podcast, and we talk
you do
all the time. And I said, "What in the hell is an LLSA? Are people going to know what that meant?" And then you were like, "Well, the people that need to know, they'll know." And I'm like, "Come on."
Really, Jeff?
LLSA. Let's set it up a little bit for the people.
You bet. LLSA is Lifetime Learning Self-Assessment. So the idea, this is part of our maintenance of certification that we have to do for emergency medicine and EMS. And the idea is that ABEM, the American Board of Emergency Medicine, the folks who do the board certification, they identify somewhere between 15 and 25 papers that they think all emergency physicians or EMS physicians need to know about. So it is now time for the 2020. So we went over and covered these papers. And nice. Interestingly, the one of my papers, my DSI paper, is in this list of articles.
Wow.
And the time that I first found out it was going to be in there was the time I first met you and Ritu. Oh. We were at the State of Jefferson EMS conference, which what seems like 5 years ago now. But,
yeah, geez, Louise.
And Ritu was one of the ones who picked the articles, and he told me that it was going to be in there. So
wow.
That's now really we finally cool. get around to taking it.
Do you get like a special thing for your wall or something that says we chose you? You're in the club?
There was, I think there was an email and that was about it. It was much more special hearing it from Ritu. So
yeah, I figured you might get a trophy or something or
maybe
a medal or something.
Yep. Not so much.
All right. Well, maybe we should just get into that and let's see what Dr. Casey Patrick has to say along with this great discussion with you.
Let's do. Oh, you know, I should probably tell you who Casey Patrick is.
Oh, yeah. Tell me a little bit more.
He is an emergency physician, an EMS physician here in Texas. He, along with Rob Dixon, are the medical directors for the Montgomery County Hospital District EMS agency. So that's a district that is just north. It's basically Conroe and the Woodlands, if you're familiar with the Houston area, north Houston suburbs. Okay. Busy system. It's actually very, very similar to our Williamson County system. So, Dr. Patrick. So let's hit it, shall we? Dr. Patrick.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
So we just finished a lecture at the 2021 Texas NAMSP conference. So this is the chapter meeting. We had a great meeting. I'm so happy to see everybody. The opportunity to sit this close to you, get in the same frame.
Wow.
Thank you, vaccines. So the lecture that Casey and I did was about the 2020 LLSA articles for EMS. And basically, if you're not familiar with what that is, LLSA is the Lifetime Learning Self-Assessment Exam. These are quizzes that we have to take, four of them every 5 years for both well, that's not quite true. It's four every 5 years for emergency medicine.
I lose track of the numbers. But
it gets confusing. It's an open book quiz on papers. So the folks at ABIM will assign us 20 to 25 papers every other year in EMS. And these are basically papers that are supposed to be practice changing or things that we should definitely know about. And then there's a quiz. So the lecture that we just gave went over the papers for the 2020 LLSA exam. And that's what we're going to do. So brief summaries, unlike most of the Lighthouse podcast where we really go in depth into one paper, this is going to be pretty superficial, top of the line stuff. And we're going to emphasize the points that people who are taking these quizzes need to know to get through the quiz. And the one thing that I will tell you is these quizzes are designed to be open book. So even though we're not going to show you the test question or read you the test question, everything we're doing is okay with ABIM. So with that said, why don't we kick it off?
Number one is the Airways 2 trial. This was an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, supraglottic airway versus endotracheal intubation, 30-day survival with good neuro outcome, a study that was performed in England. Almost 40% of the English population kind of under the umbrella of this study. The study was prospective. It was randomized. The paramedics were randomized to use either direct laryngoscopy or IGEL. And then during the duration of the study, they performed just that airway intervention on out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
Perfect. So the medic was not switching from device to device. Right. Okay, perfect.
There were about 4,500 patients in each group. And again, the primary outcome was a good patient-oriented outcome. It was modified Rankin score 0 to 3 at 30 days. And they found that the survival between the two groups, when compared, was statistically no difference. So they had a survival with good neuro outcome at 30 days from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in the 6% range.
No difference.
It's about what we expect. Now, there were some caveats in the study and some things that, you know, may have introduce bias. One of the things they talked about in the discussion was if you look at the patients who, in the study who received no advanced airway management, so just got bag valve mask, their survival was up over 20%. So then you might say, well, then why aren't we using a BVM on all our out-of-hospital cardiac arrests? Well, there's definitely some bias introduced there, because who are the patients that only get a BVM? They're the patients that are in VF that get shocked and wake up.
Exactly.
So they're not the ones we work for 10, 15, 20 minutes.
And if we go back, if you're really looking to go back and learn more about this, you can look at the episode we did on the Jabre study, talking is a non-inferiority BVM versus no BVM. They controlled for this bias and they found no difference. So yeah, this is the key thing here. Indication bias is a real thing.
So if, you know, take home point, cardiac arrest, advanced airway management, from this study at least, no difference between IGL insertion or direct laryngoscopy. For the airway managers out there, no difference in, no use of video laryngoscopy in this study. This was all DL. So, you know, in my services were primarily video laryngoscopy. So this, you know, that's a spot where may or may not apply.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things, it's not really pertinent to this quiz, but they didn't report first pass success. They reported success within two attempts. And IGL was far, far higher. I think it was like 87% within two attempts on the IGL and
mid-70s for
intracheal. So easier to use the IGL. Yep, absolutely. All right, we're going to move on to the next paper now. This is a paper by Nicole Boson and her colleagues out of the Los Angeles Fire Department in UCLA Harborview. The title of the paper is Causes of Pre-Hospital Misinterpretations of ST Elevation Myocardial Infarction, published 2017 Pre-Hospital Emergency Care. This was a descriptive study of all patients from LAFD that transmitted a 12-lead ECG. And they got this information out of their patient care record. And the specific data point that they got out was whether the machine read STEMI or not. Not what the medic thought, but what the machine read. And they categorized that as STEMI or not based on the machine read. Then they took those patients and compared it to their hospital database that had outcome information. And they, for each case, they categorized it again based on hospital diagnosis of STEMI or not. And there's a lot of bias in what the hospital would consider STEMI unless you attempt to control for it. And Nicole and her colleagues did do that. They did it the right way. So you have an EMS diagnosis, which is really a machine diagnosis, and a hospital diagnosis. They made a 2x2 contingency table, and they reported the sensitivity and specificity. And then they gave you the top reasons for both. So the key thing here is there was no paramedic judgment involved. Nothing was taken into consideration about the age, the primary impression, the complaint, any of that, machine read only. Ultimately, they had about 4,400 cases. 529 of those were adjudicated to be STEMI, and the vast majority were not, which I think indicates an interesting thing here. There were a lot of 12 leads that were probably being done for reasons other than chest pain, but those were still lumped in. And what that tells us, we have to remember that when we're looking at sensitivity and specificity, positive and negative predictive value, because if you're running a 12 lead on everybody, in the general population, hell, if we did a 12 lead on us, if there were 500 of us sitting here and we ran a 12 lead on all 500 of us, none of us have coronary artery disease, none of us have any symptoms, at least one of them is going to show STEMI. And that's just a false positive. What is the likelihood that if you or I get a 12 lead right now in the condition we're in and it says STEMI, that it's actually a STEMI? It's pretty low. So you have to think about that baseline prevalence. And they did not do that here because that really wasn't what they were looking for. So when you interpret these numbers, you have to think about that. All right. Ultimately, the top reasons for false positive 12 leads. So the machine read STEMI and the hospital said, not so fast, Buck, not a STEMI. Number one reason at 20% was artifact. There was something going on in the machine. It was still good enough for the life pack, and that's what they were using, to get an interpretation, but it was just wrong. The number two was early repolarization. That was 16%. Then pericarditis, we don't know, and LVH were in the top five. And you had mentioned you were kind of surprised that LVH and what was the other one?
Yeah, personally, in my services, I feel like that the one the medics struggle with the most is that LVH, especially the LVH left bundle combination.
Absolutely.
Interoceptal look, you know, with
yep.
definitely ST elevation, but you've got a QRS complex that's gigantic and you've got, you know, strain pattern that can get pretty confusing. But going back to something you said, it's so pretest probability is important.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't know what pretest probability means, you can take it even, you know, more big picture and say that the clinical picture matters.
Yep.
So in other words, the patient needs to have chest pain and needs to have a story. And the better that story is, the more likely, you know, we're going to need to consider activation, even if we think it could be
yep.
benign early repole or LVH. If the patient's yeah. clutching their chest and gray and ashen and diaphoretic, that clinical picture goes into the decision, obviously.
Absolutely. Critically, critically important. One other thing from this this particular paper is they also identified the false negatives. So I like to say false positives. When we activate and it's not really a STEMI, that's what keeps cardiologists up at night. The false negatives, when we don't activate and it is, that's what keeps us up at night. So the number one reason for false negatives, in other words, there really was a STEMI and the ECG didn't read it, is the ST elevation was pretty subtle, just wasn't very high, and that didn't trigger the threshold for the algorithm. So that was the number one reason. So really the summary on this, the most common cause of false positive STEMI interpretations was artifact and then non-ischemic conditions, meaning the LVH, the repole, and geez, I already forgot what was the – oh, early repole was the number one.
Pericarditis yeah. was in
there. Pericarditis, that's yeah. right. Thank you. And then you got to use clinical context, and if you reduce the artifact, you might reduce the false negative reads. Maybe so. All right.
So on to number three, this was a position statement, joint position statement between several national groups looking at spinal motion restriction and giving clinicians and pre-hospital providers instructions on best practices for spinal motion restriction. And one of the big points, SMR, spinal motion restriction, was encouraged as far as terminology. I grew up calling it spinal immobilization. Mm-hmm. Their point is we never really immobilized anyone's spine. We just restrict motion. So
yeah.
semantics, but probably valuable
yeah. yeah.
in thinking what we actually do. This consensus statement was NAMSP, ASAP, American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. So high-powered trauma folks involved here. Probably the biggest, I would say, from a dogma standpoint, changer here as far as the direction which we go or we classically go on with these patients is they finally tell us that longboards are not necessary. It's something we already knew and is, for most of you listeners out there and watchers, probably a duh statement. But they allow us, or at least recommend, the use of longboards or cots or vacuum splints or scoop stretchers for TNL spinal yep. motion restriction. They basically describe the nexus criteria as yep. far as indications for spinal motion restriction,
yep.
altered mental status, neurodeficit being the big ones there. Won't beat the nexus criteria to death. Some of
they're good. Their work, they're validated.
And
thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
And some of us, you know, consider Canadian C-spine rules as well, and that it just really includes, you know, pain with rotation or yeah. with movement. So nothing earth-shattering there. They do at least advise not reflexively applying spinal motion restriction in isolated penetrating trauma.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a again, another dogma changer. I think my training, we put C-collars on all penetrating traumas. Now, we discussed this in the meeting, and you know, the one of the case vignettes in some of the review that I've looked at a GSW to the chest, patient awake, alert, moving all extremities, no focal deficits. I would have spinally immobilized that person or applied spinal motion yeah. restriction in my back in the day, but that patient, per these recommendations, did not need
yeah.
spinal motion restriction. Now, that said, if that patient's left arm is burning or hand is yeah. weak, then obviously I'm going to put a C-collar on. So,
but you're doing that for other – they failed nexus
exactly.
in that case. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so just to summarize that again, they really were fairly clear. Isolated penetrating trauma is not an indication for spinal motion restriction. And I can buy off on that.
Yep. Appropriate size C collars are advised. Another duh statement. You can't apply spinal motion restriction in the sitting position. We probably all see this in our emergency departments. Folks with a C collar sitting up goes against these recommendations. Limit the time on longboards. We've all seen the necrotic gluteal picture from the patient on the longboard for 60 or 75 minutes. So,
I'm curious, when you saw, I've seen the same picture. Can you smell that picture?
Absolutely.
Oh my God. Let's just not do that.
It's also probably from the 50s.
Correct. Likes the NG tube and the brain.
There are other other things about that picture. I'm like, that's really old.
Right.
And you know, realistically, that is to me just akin to torture. So
yeah, absolutely.
If anybody's laying a longboard, don't get them off there. And they close out with a discussion on SMR in children. Big points there are treat kids like adults from the standpoint of if they're altered and they've had significant mechanism, they do need SMR. Do not apply or not apply SMR based on age or verbal abilities. In other words, if you have a nonverbal child who is altered, MVC, roll over.
Giddy up.
Put them in a C collar.
Yep.
And then lastly, you know, kids' heads are really big before their bodies are big. So if you, you know, place them on a scoop stretcher or on a cot, oftentimes they will hyperflex unless you apply some padding under their shoulders. So that was kind of the last point. And again, this isn't Canadian C-spine. This isn't Nexus. This isn't a C collar study or C collar statement. This is more overall spinal motion restriction.
Yeah. Yeah, I really took away that it's a position on backboards for the most part. So bottom line here, use a scoop stretcher, vacuum splint, cot, or if you need to, primarily for extrication, you can use a backboard, but it's not required. Altered children, put them in a C-collar, assuming mechanism, and penetrating trauma is not a sole indication for spinal motion restriction.
That's it for that one. Let's move on to number four.
So interestingly, I have never talked about this paper on this podcast. Seriously, I haven't covered it. It just seems kind of.
You really haven't?
I haven't. No, okay. It seems kind of self-promoting to me. But for, you know, let me go ahead and promote it. This was a paper that we did at Williamson County. I was the lead author on it. John Gonzalez, Danny Johns, and Lauren Sager was our statistician epidemiologist. The title of the paper was Implementation of a Clinical Bundle to Reduce Out-of-Hospital Peri-Intubation Hypoxia. This was 2018 in Annals of Emergency Medicine. So this was a before and after study done at Williamson County. Basically, we realized we had a problem. We had a peri-intubation cardiac arrest as a result of hypoxia. Induced hypoxia, we did that. And we said, we can't be doing that. We need to look at the literature, find out all of the things that you can do to safely intubate, and we need to do those things. So what we were doing before, and just to be clear, this is on non-cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest, different ballgame. We're intubating patients for non-cardiac arrest, so your RSIs. We were pre-oxygenating to the extent that we were pre-oxygenating. We're using a non-rebreather mask. We did do apneic oxygenation. We used ketamine plus either sucks or rock, depending on what we could get at the time. And throughout this entire study, the only laryngoscope we were using was the King Vision channeled. So video for everybody. So I would say that's probably what the majority of RSI systems are doing. Mm-hmm. Non-rebreather pre-ox plus or minus apneic oxygenation and then intubate. Plus or minus again, VL.
And I would go further and say that's probably what most emergency physicians are doing. You know, DL, VL, probably some for us getting older folks still.
Exactly. Pick up the gray hairs.
Yeah. There's a few now. That's what teenagers do to you. But that's a pretty standard approach. I mean, I would almost say that, you know, at the time that y'all did the study, if you looked at my airway practice in the emergency department, I may have used Etomidate. I probably wasn't even using apneic oxygenation then. So my approach was probably even more bare bones than this.
I'll tell you, that's kind of what I did too. I was an Etomidate sucks guy. We went to ketamine with EMS, so I started using ketamine. But pre-oxing, I was pre-oxygenating with an non-rebreather. Yeah. And if you look at, there's a recent paper that I think we're going to cover in Lighthouse on one of the NEAR studies. Mm-hmm. It's a National Emergency Airway Registry. The number one way to pre-ox is non-rebreather. Turns out that sucks. Horrible way to pre-ox. Don't do it. So that leads us to what did we do in the after group? So we did a bunch of training. We implemented checklists, some goal-driven things, some absolutes. And the bundle was every patient that we're going to intubate who's not in cardiac arrest had the – we intubated them on the stretcher, head of the bed – I didn't mandate the stretcher. If they can elevate the head in bed or wherever they are, go for it. But the head had to be elevated. They had to be in an aorto-sternal notch position. We did apneic oxygenation at flush rates. We did non-invasive ventilation on them, and we did it the old-fashioned way with a BVM with a two-handed seal, lifting the mandible, not pushing it into the mask. We used PEEP and flush rate on both the nasal cannula and BVM. And that's another way of saying CPAP. So non-invasive ventilation. We did use apneic oxygenation all the way through the intubation. We did delayed sequence intubation where we gave ketamine, got the SATs up to 93 or above, and held them there for at least 3 minutes. So that is for the nitrogen washout. That's true pre-oxygenation. It's not the best measure of pre-oxygenation. The best measure is end tidal oxygen, and ain't nobody got that on our monitors.
Pretty expensive.
You have to have a gas analyzer right now. I'm talking to you, Physio and Zoll and Phillips. We need this on our monitors. But in the absence of that, you got to go with 3 minutes. We did that. And again, we did VL only. And we said, if you don't meet all of those criteria, you don't intubate. Use an IGL instead. Our primary outcome was peri-intubation hypoxia. Bottom line, went from 44% before, which is right in line with emergency medicine literature and EMS, and it went down to 4%. So the bundle works. That's the bottom line. There were some other findings. The primary one is that our scene time went up. It went up by about 9 minutes. And our duration of attempts went down. So it actually took us less time to get the patient intubated. But it's important to know that that was not statistically significant.
And, you know, waterfall plot in the study is beautiful. But all of the statistics aside, I feel strongly I've copied this everywhere I've went in my own personal practice and in my EMS services since this study. It's really just a beautiful example of looking at a problem that you see in your service, addressing it, studying it, reporting it for the rest of us to see. Super impactful. And this is the way that if we're using sedatives and paralytics in the pre-hospital setting, I'd argue in the ED setting, this is the approach. This is the correct approach. This, you know, 9 minute scene time increase. Well, I'll take 9 minutes of increased scene time to have decreased cardiac arrest.
Absolutely.
And so that, to me, that is an absolute no-brainer trade-off. Yeah. So if you're out there looking for that model for airway management in EMS or in the emergency department, this is it.
Well, I appreciate
feel
that.
Strongly. So
actually, I think this one's mine too. Yeah. Dr. Klebichar, the title of the paper is Incidence of Naloxone Redosing in the Age of the New Opioid Epidemic. And this was published pre-hospital emergency care in 2017 based on data from even earlier than that. So this was a single retrospective descriptive study done from one system in New Jersey. All ALS systems in New Jersey are hospital-based. And they looked at all adults who got at least one dose of intranasal naloxone. And their primary outcome was the incidence of repeat naloxone dosing. So how many times did you have to give it? Again, because we're dealing with these super opioids, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the concern. We're definitely seeing more of them now, probably than they did in this study.
Sure.
So the results that we're talking about were real at the time. Maybe the difference, maybe more sufentanil or whatever might be changing this. All right. So what did they find? 91% of patients had what they called complete reversal with the first dose of naloxone. And that means that their GPS.
Where are you located?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you awake?
Apparently it's in New Jersey.
Eyes.
Your GC. GCS went back to 15. And they found that in those patients who returned to baseline, GCS 15, after one dose of naloxone, there were no subsequent doses needed. And that's probably the important thing. So bottom line in this study is, 9%, only 9% of patients treated with IN naloxone needed a second dose. And of those patients with at least with the first dose who returned to baseline, they didn't need any additional Narcan. And I really think this is important because it informs our decisions about how hard to push for transport to the hospital.
And there's, you know, there's other literature out there that echoes this. Yeah. There's a LA study showed the same thing. With the exception that there is, I think all of these that I've looked at, most of the time, these folks are fine. Yeah. There is a small percentage where they're not going to be. And, you know, usually the, you know, the clinical factors on top of them not right. being normal.
There's,
you
know, something else there.
Abnormal vital signs, abnormal mental status, some, you know, some just bizarre, you know, comorbidities and other things like that.
Oh, it might have been the bone eating metastatic cancer they had. Then that's the reason they ate the fentanyl.
Yeah.
So one other thing about this, if we are thinking to get away from this paper, one thing we noticed is 27%, back up one slide. Sure. I think it was 27%. Yeah. 27% of patients, that they treated with naloxone, they had treated with naloxone for a prior overdose, which means that there was probably a higher proportion of them that had had prior overdoses. And the reason that's important is if you are going to do. No worries. If you are going to do release on scene, realize that opioid abuse is a chronic condition and there is a treatment for it. Medication induced or medication assisted therapy, basically BUPE, works. It's very helpful. It saves lives. Naloxone saves lives. So if you have a process where you're going to be leaving these people on scene, do your patients a favor, leave them naloxone and get them into a BUPE program. I know there are some places that are actually giving them the first dose of BUPE. Mm-hmm. Get them into a program. If you can't do those things, I'd probably err on the side of transporting them. Not because we're worried about them relapsing again on this overdose, but because this is a chronic disease and is likely to happen.
Yeah, and then if you look at the mortality data for patients post-overdose, and then the next year, yeah. you're looking at 10% plus, yeah. which is equivalent to a STEMI. You know, very yeah. rarely do we let a STEMI walk out into the parking lot without complete treatment.
Yep.
So if we can start these folks on buprenorphine, their outcomes are yeah. markedly better. I know there's been the recent discussion around the X waiver and whether yeah. or not it's required.
We should X it out.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the fact that we had to go through the X waiver was ridiculous.
Absolutely.
That said, I went through the process and there's a lot to be, I learned a lot from going yeah. through it. So I would encourage anybody out there who's not familiar with buprenorphine and its physiology and the mortality benefits there to take a quick look, because it's pretty impressive when you start to compare the numbers.
I need to get off my ass and take that class.
It painful in the sense that you got to sit through 6 hours.
Right.
But as far as spending 6 hours, I got a lot out of it and felt like it's a patient population that definitely is my practice probably been neglected.
Yeah.
So moving into paper number 6, this is a paper by Patterson et al. Evidence-based guidelines for fatigue risk management in EMS. This was at a pre-hospital emergency care in 2018.
Perfect.
So
I will notice one additional thing. Do you see who the senior author was? Is Doug Kupis, who also is the primary author on another
GCS
paper. So
motor.
He got a he got a twofer in this one. Strong work, Doug.
Yeah, and Patterson out of Pitt, actually, we at MCHD, we just were partnered with them on another fatigue related survey study. So it was pretty cool that our medics actually got to contribute there.
Yeah.
It was we were pretty excited to be a part of that, because as we all know, fatigue is an everyday issue in EMS.
And I'm going to have a little coffee here.
Have some coffee. Yeah, it's a nice product placement. And what they did was they looked at a ginormous batch of literature and tried to take questions and answer those questions from that ginormous batch related to fatigue. So they asked 7 to start with, 7 questions, and they found enough literature and enough support to answer 5 of them. All of the literature that supported these 5 answers was weak to very weak. So none of these are backed up by really solid stuff, yeah. but some of this stuff is a little bit common sense as well. Yeah. Recommendation or answer to the initial question, recommendation number one is that we should be using fatigue surveys for our medics in our services. In other words, we should at periodic time points ask them if they're fatigued or not. Please do not come at me with pitchforks and, you know, the torches.
Cares about what you're about to
run
say.
Run me out of my house. I know that this is a touchy subject, but
– but?
Shifts should be less than 24 hours.
They should.
And that's based on pure safety. You know, yeah. Pilots don't fly 24 hours straight.
Nope. Truck drivers.
Truck drivers, you know.
So ER doctors would never work at – oops.
I quit working 24s. I can say I am not being hypocritical here. And my I feel like my practice quality and, more importantly, my attitude quality
has improved.
I was not a kind person at 4 a.m. after I got to work the day before at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
So my own personal experience, while I'm just like the medics listening out there, like to have – fewer days work and more days off. That's the benefit of a 24.
Absolutely.
I also know that I had some patient complaints that were well earned and well deserved.
Yeah.
From being tired and sleep inertia at 4 a.m.
What's the sleep inertia?
So sleep inertia. Then one of the next leads us into the next recommendation, and that is that naps should be encouraged and available for long shifts. So I saw my 30 patients between 7 a.m. and 3 a.m. So my first, you know, 20 hours or so, I went back to the sleep room. I laid down. I took a nap. You know, a 25-year-old with abdominal pain checked in at 3:30. I got 30 minutes of nap and woke up and was in a daze.
Yeah.
A little bit groggy. That's sleep inertia.
Yep.
So nap should be available. The downside of naps is sleep inertia. That might be a point to remember. Caffeine should be available. There's Jeff with his coffee. I'm a weirdo that's not a coffee drinker. Disclaimer.
That's it. Podcast
I'm off now. I shouldn't have told him that. But I do drink an occasional soda with caffeine. And so they didn't give any recommendation on dose and when in the shift, what point, what would your
what's your delivery device of
delivery choice? Delivery device. I would say to the listeners out there, probably not amps and monsters. That is a little bit, you know, I think there is a dose range that's appropriate here.
And that's probably above it.
I've seen way too much AFib RVR and 25-year-olds from amps and monsters.
And I'll tell you, there's a complete tangent, but it's not just caffeine in those things, too.
Yes, very true.
Just because it's natural and it's an herb doesn't mean it won't kill you.
Hemlock is natural.
Hemlock
Ask Socrates about that. So
I ate what?
Exactly.
Bad joke, sorry.
Survey fatigue, shifts less than 24 hours, caffeine available, allow napping, and lastly, educate medics on the risks of fatigue and how those can, you know, how that can affect, you know, our risk. I know there's the, you know, from an EM resident standpoint and, a residency training standpoint, there's all the studies that look at, folks post night shift that, they get in the driver simulator and they drive like a drunk.
Or they get in their real car and they have a collision. We have lost residents. They've been killed in car crashes. We lose paramedics. Austin EMS lost a medic driving home. I think most of us can come up with a story similar to that. It's dangerous. It's absolutely like driving drunk. It's driving impaired.
So we should educate our medics on the risk of fatigue. They asked a couple other questions that they couldn't find enough evidence to answer related to fatigue risk management, using modeling and task load interventions. Probably not.
Couldn't
a whole
even
lot.
Reach very weak.
Yeah,
evidence.
No evidence.
Just nothing
at
there.
All. So I think we hit the main points there. Caffeine available, sleep inertia is a risk of naps, shifts should be less than 24 hours.
Yep. My own guys, I'm hypocritical as hell here because my own guys do 24s.
We do
some
too.
Places they do 48s. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right.
This one's yours.
Mine.
Listen up, everyone. This is the important one of the bunch.
Well, and
Jeff's probably already done this.
Oh my God. I believe our record for longest podcast was on epinephrine. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go over this one pretty quickly. The citation is Dr. Perkins and his colleagues, a randomized trial of epinephrine in out of hospital cardiac arrest. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018. This is the paramedic 2 trial. So this was a, just as a quick reminder, double blind, placebo controlled, randomized control trial in the UK. It was, all adult cardiac arrest, and they randomized you to get either 1 milligram, 1 to 10,000 epinephrine every 3 to 5 minutes or placebo. The paramedics couldn't tell what they were giving, and their primary outcome in an intention to treat analysis was 30-day survival. And their bottom line,
go ahead if you don't mind,
their bottom line was that survival was higher, statistically significant using an intention to treat. That is survival at any cost. Now, it was there for survival to hospital admission and survival to hospital discharge, which makes sense if it's 30-day survival. The magnitude, though, was 0.8% increase. All right. Good neurological survival, no difference.
But
the two groups were a little bit different. But the biggest thing is – the biggest but –
is the length. What about the length of time to epi?
Exactly. How it took too long to give epi. It took 21 minutes. 21 minutes.
We give epi within 3 minutes of scene arrival at MCHD, 2 minutes of scene arrival. What are they? 21 minutes does not apply to my service.
Right. Yeah. It's those Brits. It must be the teeth. That's the difference. Poor Brits. They have fluoride now. We still hold that against them. So the issue, that 21 minutes was measured from their version of 911. So it was from the time of collapse to administration. But still, I think it's a reasonable question. Is that longer than what we see? Go ahead.
And I will say that my initial look at this and initial listen through some of the podcasts and some of the, you know, the blog takes on this study was that 21 minutes, and this is my own fault for not looking closely and looking at what that duration was, but I was under the impression that 21 minutes was from medic arrival to epi administration. And I initially tossed this and said, that's not applicable to our service.
Yep.
Jeff here reads thoroughly in the methods, which I generally skip. So what was that duration and how does that compare to us?
So 21 minute median duration. And I will tell you, I did a study of ESO data with a really pretty, what are these called? Violin plots that I'm going to put up here. So Sam Kordick is the reason I did this plot. The whole reason I did this is I was looking for an excuse to do this plot. Beautiful plot, but basically bottom line, 21 minutes call to epinephrine in paramedic 2, 16 and a half, 17 minutes in the U.S. Well, that's still 5 minutes faster, 4 minutes faster. I don't think that's a difference. So if you look at the prior work on the benefit that shows early epinephrine is useful, they're talking about in under 10 minutes from collapse to over 10 minutes. Both of these are over. I think this applies to us.
So when you hear it was way longer, it doesn't apply to the U.S., it was not 21 minutes longer than what we're used to. It was 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's up to you as the medical director to decide whether or not that's important to you. When taken in context with what Jeff's going to tell you next.
Yeah. So I said 0.8% improved survival, statistically significant. That was their primary outcome. But they did find something incredibly important. There was no difference in neurologic survival, which is pretty much what we had seen before. But they tracked survivors. And they said, what was the neurologic status of those patients who survived? And what they found was almost double the rate of neurologic devastation in patients who were given epinephrine. So that's an odds ratio of 1.74, 74% increased odds of neurologic devastation among survivors who were given epinephrine. And the reason I stress among the survivors is one of their primary outcomes was difference in neurologic survival, and they said there's no difference. Well, why am I now saying epinephrine causes neurologic devastation? Because I'm adding the phrase among survivors. The reason that there was no difference in overall neurologic outcome is the vast majority of patients in both groups died, and that watered down the impact. So overall, there was more neurologic devastation. So bottom line, epinephrine improves survival, but it improves neurologic devastation among survivors. This paper did a great job of trying to put this into context. So they calculated the number needed to treat. Number needed to treat, if you have to treat 112 patients with epinephrine to get one additional survivor. They put that in context of something like early defibrillation, which you need to treat 5 patients to get one additional survival. That, by the way, is neurologically intact survival. So 5 compared to 112. You have to take that into consideration of number needed to harm by having increased neurologic devastation among survivors. That number needed to harm is 8. That's a little less than 112. They also did a Bayesian analysis that said, what is the probability of getting at least 2% or greater functional neurologic outcome with epinephrine? It was 0.000. I think that's my takeaway. But I was talking to Jose Cabanas the other day, and I was blaming him for everything I find objectionable about the Heart Association, which was not in any way, shape, or form fair to him. The guy volunteers a lot of time to help us, and what do? I get irritated and yell at him in a bar. So, Jose, I'm sorry about that. But he makes a good point. People overinterpret paramedic 2 to say, don't use epinephrine. And I want to be clear, as much as I'm going to beat the Heart Association up about increasing their level of evidence, which I don't think you can do, we should also be clear to say we're not saying stop using epinephrine. I think you should use it early and then probably less than we are right now. We just know what we're doing now isn't getting us the outcomes we want. We should do something different. We definitely know more is not the outcome. Great trials on that. Maybe less, maybe different. We don't know. Hopefully we'll find out at some point.
And I would, you know, editorial comments alert here. I probably fall further towards the camp of, you know, the patients that we're saving here are neurologically devastated. And I do think there's an ethical component to that.
Yeah.
From a, you know, from a population, a public health based standpoint, I think, you know, that's just something that we really have to think hard about. So I'm not, I probably am further to the camp. I'm not sure epi is the right drug in the way that it's currently being given.
Absolutely.
So that said, I would almost fall to the pause until we see, you know, is it a within 10 minutes? Is the 10 minute cutoff? Yeah. I mean, because in especially some of the urban services and some of the, you know, the more population dense spots, it's, you know, there are plenty of calls we run on where we get to the patient within 10 minutes. And maybe a milligram of epi is a good thing for that patient. Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to put a time clock on it. You know, there's other folks out there that are doing continuous epi drips so you don't get the surge. Maybe it's,
thank you, Dr. Abraham.
Maybe it's a half of a milligram of epi. Maybe it's a smaller dose.
We just don't know right now.
And one thing about this study is when you, that randomized control placebo blinded thing that you talked about at the beginning that always makes my brain and my eyes gloss over a little bit on that hierarchy of evidence. That's at the top. So they did the study very, very well. There's nothing they could have done really from my standpoint that would have made this study any more valid.
So one thing I have to point out, I got beat up on Twitter about this because that's what Twitter is for, is beating people up.
Stay off social media, people.
And the act, because I said that, I think it is unethical to keep doing what we're doing. And I got beat up for paternalism in medicine. So physicians making decisions for patients in the absence of their consent. And he really beat me up about it. The thing I want to say about this, and physicians historically have been guilty of about paternalism, but this study actually refers to some additional studies and work they did to get IRB approval to do it, where they ask patients what patients value. And they, there is another study here that looks at the minimal clinically important difference. What would patients consider an important difference? And they say 2% functional neurologic outcome. In order to use an intervention, they would like to see 2% improved functional neurologic outcome. And what we see with the Bayesian analysis they did is the probability of getting 2% or higher is zero. It's goose eggs. I don't think what we're doing is paternalism.
No, and some of this goes into bigger picture items, you know, public education and public health knowledge. And, you know, AEM was just this past week as well. And You know, Alma too gives a wonderful talk. If anybody's not seen it, it's definitely worth looking at from an EMS standpoint.
Because you could have just stopped at Alma too. Well, anything he does is great.
He talks about the portrayal of cardiac arrest in pop culture media. And the survival rates of cardiac arrest in pop culture. And so if you ask most patients, they think, and most people out there think that med students was one of the ones they looked at. Even med students think cardiac arrest survival. I think it was third year or fourth year med students in the study that he presents. They think survival's 40%.
Oh my God.
When we know that it's abysmal. And, you know, if a patient could see a modified Rankin score of 5.
Yeah. See what that means. Change the diaper, change the peg tube.
And I agree. I don't want to be paternalistic. I don't.
Yeah.
I know that we've made our errors there in the past, and we deserve that.
Yeah.
You know, extra consideration. But for an MRS of 5, I feel pretty confident that's not paternalism. That's patient advocacy from my standpoint.
I agree. I just got to get my quote in here.
Go for
Epinephrine saves the heart at the expense of the brain. Remember that. You heard it here first.
So moving on to
Doug's second paper.
Yeah, Dr. Kupas again. Glasgow Coma Scale motor component performs similarly to total Glasgow Coma Scale in predicting severe injury and trauma patients. So where was the idea for this? What problem were they trying to solve? In the field trauma triage guidelines, GCS of 13 or less is indicator for trauma facility activation. Transfer, yeah. Trauma activation. And in the background, the intro of the paper, they talk about the inter-rater reliability and the agreement of emergency physicians in calculating total GCS, EMV. And it's somewhere in the neighborhood of a third agree. Not good. Even just the motor component, only about 3/4 agree. So the idea is, can we just use the motor component to predict who needs trauma activation? So in other words, how well does GCS less than 6 predict severe trauma as compared to total GCS? And they were looking for a 5% difference. Again, that was the number that they decided would be significant and make one better than the other. And they used area under the curve to compare the two at predicting severe trauma. And they used several markers. They used ISS greater than 15, greater than 24, trauma intervention, death, intubation, ICU care. So all markers of sick patients. And when you look at the area under the curve for predicting these events, any of those, they're all about the same.
Yep.
Less than the 5% difference that they initially said was their significant difference. They did not use statistical significance because they had a huge number of patients and they were all statistically significantly different, but they were looking at more of a clinical significance instead of statistics.
Yep.
So bottom line, if you ask a patient, hey, do you know where you are? What's your name? And they can't answer that. They can't follow commands, i.e. their GCS motor score is less than 6. It's just as accurate as GCS 13 or less in needing a trauma activation.
So I like it.
Simplifies what we do.
Yep.
Number 9 is Henry Wang and that group. Effect of a strategy of initial laryngeal tube insertion versus endotracheal intubation on 72-hour survival in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, a randomized clinical trial from JAMA in 2018.
The PART trial.
And if you... And Jeff has discussed this one quite a bit. This is the basically the first cousin, twin of
published
Airways
in the
two.
Same edition of JAMA.
Almost the exact same time period of data collection as well, looking at not IGELs and direct laryngoscopy, but the King tube and mostly DL. There was a couple VL services. This was the EMS services within the ROC consortium, and they randomized the service, not the medic.
Right.
And the service in 3 to 5 month blocks were given instructions to either perform SGA placement or endotracheal intubation for their out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
Maybe they trained, maybe they didn't.
Yeah, no clear pre-training. And there was also in this one, one of the other differences, probably didn't mention with Airways, was no, the confirmation was based on service protocols.
Right.
In Airways 2, there was in-title required.
Most did use in-title, at least color metric.
Yeah. And they, different outcomes in Airways 2, 30-day neural intact survival. In this, the primary outcome was 72-hour survival.
Yep.
And they found 72-hour survival slightly improved with supraglottic placement.
2.9%,
Around 18% versus 15% for endotracheal intubation. All the other secondary outcomes, neural intact survival, survival to discharge, ROSC, all favored endotracheal, or excuse me, king tube placement as well. Was there a but? The big but in this one was the first pass success. They didn't measure success based on two attempts like in Airways 2. They measured first pass success, and the first pass success for endotracheal intubation in this study was 51%. So folks like us might argue that's
they sucked at intubation.
Probably should do a better job of QI, QAing their intubation and improving that first pass success.
Or don't intubate. They're pretty good at King LT, 90%. And there's no downside to it. It looks like all the other things were about roughly equal. There was this issue about displacement.
And that's, to be honest, the more displacement with the endotracheal intubation, I would say that it, that number also include unrecognized. Maybe that's just a misplacement to start that was
it
recognized
is.
Later.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that.
I find it, in my experience, is the the seated improperly king tube is much more common.
Amen.
If you're using in-title than a misplaced endotracheal tube.
Yep. If you know that you're looking for four-phase waveform instead of that little camelback thing.
Stair step downward is always bad.
Yep.
The again, all the trends were for better outcomes with supraglottic airways in this study. If you correct for other variables with between the two groups, those go away.
Yeah.
And that is, in, while these were randomized, there was some differences between the groups.
They got standard, there faster.
Bystander CPR, medics got there faster, some other things that would obviously affect outcomes outside of the airway. So big point, no difference in adverse events between the two approaches. When corrected or when the differences in groups were corrected for statistically, no statistically significant difference in 72-hour mortality with supraglottic airway versus endotracheal intubation. Again, I would argue that not 100% valid in that primarily DL, compared to what we do, primarily DL and a very low first pass success rate. So if you can't intubate well, patients are probably better off with the supraglottic.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think it was a great study. The question is how well can we extrapolate to our practice where our first pass success rate is 90% with VL only? I don't know. We just did a podcast. I believe it was two episodes ago from Bend, Oregon. We were talking with Peter and Amber Hosick about a couple of secondary analysis on PART. But go back and take a look at that one. Well, let's go to our next paper now. This is Dr. Nishijama and her colleagues, or his colleagues, I don't know. And the title of the paper is Out of Hospital Triage of Older Adults with Head Injury, a Retrospective Study of the Effect of Adding Anticoagulation or Antiplatelet Medication Use as a Criterion. This was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine 2017. And at this point, I think we should have a rule in journals that you, if you have to like stop to breathe while you're reading
your
title's too damn long.
Fair. I like that.
So this was a retrospective study, EMR review, chart review. They looked at five different hospitals or five EMS systems, 11 hospitals, and they looked at what they called geriatric patients with head trauma. I got some nits to pick with this. Their definition was greater than 55 years old. Now, according to this, I am not yet geriatric, but I am knocking on the door, and I disapprove. Thumbs down.
What happened to 65?
I'm telling you. So their primary outcome was intracerebral hemorrhage. Secondary was death or neurosurgery. Basically, what they're looking at is how well does the CDC trauma triage criteria do? Steps 1, 2, and 3. That's the anatomic, physiologic mechanism of injury. How well does it do at predicting either intracerebral hemorrhage as the primary or death or neurosurgery? And they wonder if adding in as a separate criteria use of antiplatelet or anticoagulation would improve that. And the bottom line is that there were, yeah, I think it probably would increase the sensitivity. So if you say in addition to mechanistic criteria, anatomic, physiologic criteria, if you add in anticoagulation use, then you're going to increase sensitivity. They did find that specificity dropped. And the other things that they found, aspirin was the most common of drugs used. It wasn't Plavix. It wasn't warfarin. And fall from standing was the most common mechanism.
And the only caveat I'd add for the real world folks out there, yes, aspirin was the most common.
Right.
Aspirin's also far and away the most commonly used.
Yes.
So I would, my antenna would still be up higher for the Coumadin, warfarin, Xarelto, Eliquis,
yeah,
rivaroxaban, apixaban group out there.
It is
trade interesting. Trade and generic for all you sticklers.
They didn't see any use of those direct NOACs, which is, I think, an indication of when they did the study.
Before.
We're putting it in the water supply now.
Yep. Next one is Spate and others. This was from the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2017, the effect of combined out-of-hospital hypotension and hypoxia on traumatic brain injury. And this was a descriptive study that looked at the EPIC Registry Excellence in Pre-Hospital Injury Care, maybe.
Let's go with that.
I think I've got a 50-50 shot there again.
We'll find out if Ben Barbaro listens to the podcast. Ben, if you correct us, let me just go ahead and say I'm sorry.
Yeah. They looked at patients transported to level 1 trauma centers in Arizona. 13,000 patients were included in the initial look. Patients with head injury older than 10 years old.
Yep.
And the outcome was survival to hospital discharge, so good patient-oriented outcome. And they wanted to know the association of hypoxia, hypotension, and or both with mortality. So in other words, if you were hypoxic, did that increase your risk of death? If you were hypotensive, did that increase your risk of death? And if you had both,
bingo,
how did that play? And one of the surprising things to me from this one is the lack of literature about this that existed. Mm-hmm. This was far and away the largest look at this group of patients. And they had a really good EMS record available. So what was hypotensive? What was hypoxic? Any systolic less than 90, single reading. Any hypoxia less than 90, single reading. And they found some pretty impressive numbers. In other words,
sometimes the chart tells it all. And this
graph hits it. You don't want to be hypoxic. You don't want to be hypotensive. And you surely don't want to be both if someone whacks you in the head with a bat. Yeah. Your odds ratio for mortality, 4.4 for hypotension, 6.6 for hypoxia, and 13.2 for both. More than doubles your odds ratio of mortality when you have both hypoxia and hypotension. This in separation, if you could have one, hypoxia is worse than hypotension.
If you have to.
They did not look at treatment in this study, so stay tuned for the next round of LLSA articles. There will be a follow-up to this one.
Absolutely. So let me point this out here. In 2022, the LLSA articles have already been released. Spate and Barbaro again did a follow-up. That's really important paper that I'm pretty sure we have discussed. As a matter of fact, I know we've discussed it on the pod and we discussed it with Ben on the podcast. But the other thing I want to say about the 2022 list is Casey is on there and his great paper on IV nitroglycerin, push dose nitro for acute decompensated heart failure is on the list. Read it. We will definitely be talking about that coming back and doing an interview.
We've got that was year one. We've got year two and three. Safe and effective. Don't be afraid.
We adopted it. We just blatantly stole what you did.
So moving on to the next one. This one's yours.
Yeah. Kate Remick, our good friend. So Kate The senior author on this is Marianne Gachet Hill, who is just a legend in PEDS EMS, has done wonderful stuff. I really like her. She's been great to me.
PEDS title of the PEDS paper, Airways bags. Is that okay?
Yeah. I'm going to take a pass on that. The title of the paper, Pre-Hospital Glucose Testing for Children with Seizures, A Proposed Change in Management. This is Pre-Hospital Emergency Care 2017. This really should change your practice. So they looked, it was an observational study, all pediatric patients under the age of 14 transported by Los Angeles Fire to Harbor UCLA PEDS Emergency Department with seizures. And what they wanted to know is how often were these patients hypoglycemic? And they wanted to take a look and say, do we need to be measuring glucose? And so what they did, go ahead. They found 770 pediatric patients with seizures. And what they found is only 14% of them were actually seizing when EMS arrived, exactly what we always know. Seizures stop on their own, almost always, you know, except when they don't. There was no difference in the blood glucose in the field between those who were seizing and those who were not, meaning actively seizing. 12% of them were still seizing upon ED arrival. So if they were seizing on arrival to EMS, 14%, they're probably going to still be seizing when they get to the emergency department. Other trials, Rampart in particular, said you need more benzos. Give more benzos. Interestingly, they found that the blood glucose was higher in those patients who were seizing than in those who were not.
So we don't need to check the sugar?
We don't need to check the sugar.
And straight away?
Straight away. That's it. Let's go to the next slide. The new algorithm that they see basically says if the patient is not seizing and is back to normal, don't poke their little finger. Glucose is not the problem. If they are still seizing, give them benzos first. And then while you're giving them more benzos, go ahead and check their glucose level. Or if they're not seizing anymore and they're still altered, check their blood glucose level. But if they're back to normal and they're not seizing, don't check it. And let's take a look at the summary points. Less than 0.5% of all pediatric seizure patients had hypoglycemia, 0.5. Not very many. Measure blood glucose only if they're still seizing or if they're altered.
This is one of those that asks a very valuable question, answers it, and challenges some dogma. If you work in one of my services as a medic, undifferentiated altered status obviously still needs
different
blood glucose.
Game.
And if a patient is actively seizing, treat the seizure first, check the glucose second.
Yep.
If they stop seizing and they're back to normal, it wasn't their glucose.
That ain't the problem. And by the way, just for the record, hypoglycemia does not cause syncope. Unless you collapse, fall on like a glucagon syringe and somehow increase your blood glucose.
And I've never seen that one in my practice.
I have not. Of course, I also haven't seen injury, initial visit, fall from aircraft, sucked into engine, or fall from spacecraft. Mm-hmm. Now, you're closer to Houston. Maybe you have. I haven't.
No, not yet.
If you were perhaps injured because you fell, maybe in Brownsville. You fall from a spacecraft down at, Elon Musk's place, and you're being transported by helicopter.
Multi-system trauma.
Sick. You're sick. Should we give you blood? Or, I'm sorry, the answer is yes. Should we give you plasma? That's the question that Dr. Sperry and Guyette answered in this paper. This is pre-hospital plasma during air medical transport in trauma patients at risk for hemorrhagic shock, New England Journal of Medicine, 2018. This is the PAMPER trial, y'all. We've talked about this one also.
Okay.
27 HIMSS bases, randomized control trial, standard of care versus 2 units, thawed plasma, indications, 1 episode of hypotension and tachycardia, or 1 episode of profound hypotension, age between 17 and 90, and you had IV access. They excluded the things you would expect them to exclude. And what was their bottom line primary outcome? 30-day mortality, 10% improvement in survival with 2 units of packed plasma. That's the bottom line. Better survival, 10% improvement. There was no difference in short-term outcomes if you happen to be taking a test. No difference in short-term adjusted outcomes except for lower PTT scores, which I don't think anybody cares about, and limited shelf life. That's the big problem with plasma. That's why more of us aren't using it.
So moving into the what I believe is the last one, Smith, Shapiro et al. This was a really a kind of a descriptive look at mass shootings in the United States, the profile of wounding and civilian public mass shooting fatalities. The gist behind this, the reason why they picked this to look at, was their hypothesis was that military shooting injuries are different patterns than the civilian mass shootings that we've seen in the United States increase over the last 20, 25 years. Most of our treatment paradigms, most of our treatment protocols are all based on military data. So they surmise that, wait a minute, the gunshot wounds that our soldiers incur are going to be different than what you would at a nightclub or a movie theater, right, or in Las Vegas. You know, you name the shooting. So how did they determine this? They looked at autopsy reports and they looked at the various sites of injury. They tried to determine from the autopsy report where the fatal site was and if there was any potentially survivable injuries. How they defined that, they said, well, if that patient in that particular scenario had access to EMS within 10 minutes and mm-hmm. a trauma surgeon within an hour, then they could have potentially gotten definitive care that would have saved yep. them. We looked at 12 civilian mass shootings, 139 fatalities, and what they found was that military death rate is much lower than civilian shooting death rate, which is not shocking in that our soldiers wear armor and helmets. They found that
I actually was surprised by that.
Really?
Yeah. Now, when you think about it, it makes sense. But I would have thought that a combat zone where you're actively being fired at by a bunch of people with big guns would be more dangerous than going to church or going somewhere else. And for the most part, because even though we see mass shootings in the news all the time and they're becoming way more frequent, still your odds of getting shot at in church are less than in Afghanistan. But the patterns are definitely different, and I think we need to learn from that.
I guess Jeff's point is once you have been shot.
Exactly. Once somebody walks in and starts shooting, if you're a civilian, you're going to be much worse off than if you're in the military.
And they found that in the civilian mass shootings, over half had wounds to their head and chest. There was a very low rate of potentially survivable injuries, only 7%.
Yep.
And a large, almost 90% of those were chest wounds. And what did they take from that? Well, the focus for the last 2-3 years, for a lot of our public outreach and a lot of our public education, interactions with law enforcement, has been the Stop the Bleed program and tourniquets, tourniquets, tourniquets. And while please, we're not
keep using them. Yeah,
we are not knocking tourniquets here, but the evidence from this study tells us that there really weren't a whole lot of people out there that had gunshot wounds through and through to the, you know, the upper arm and the brachial artery or, you know, the thigh that could have been, you know, saved with a tourniquet. So from that standpoint, keep doing what you're doing. I guess don't expect miracles tourniquets. And realistically, with a high percentage of survivable chest injuries, maybe things like finger thoracostomies and chest seals may be more beneficial, or at least try to push that treatment paradigm forward to non-medics in these situations, maybe.
Yeah. So I think we've done a pretty good job. I think the next police officer you see on duty, ask them. My guess is they have a tourniquet on there. You're seeing far more of them. Maybe what we need is they need a pack that has a tourniquet, has quick clot, but also has a dart and a chest seal. And maybe we need to push that more to our first responders. Yeah, absolutely.
So for the high points, very low rate of survival injury, 7%. Maybe mass tourniquets aren't the answer. Chest seal, chest darts may help. Finger thoracostomy. And then the most common region for injury in these civilian shootings was the head.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of times these folks are targeting people. They have, you know, they have scopes. They're trying to, inflict damage. So that's not terribly shocking.
Yeah. And, you know, the other big difference is in combat, you typically are not close up. I think most people now do a pretty good job. If they see the enemy coming at them, they're going to try to stop them. So you're looking at much your engagement distance is pretty far off. Unlike civilian shootings, the engagement is much closer because somebody walks in and you don't see them with a gun. And then the bottom line, like you mentioned, is in combat, we would have far more deaths from head injuries if we weren't wearing helmets, far more death from central truncal wounds if we weren't wearing armor. The only place left to kill a soldier is to blow him up, which is, you know, explosions were the number one cause of death in combat, or get an artery. And that's why tourniquets are so important in combat. We got a lot more exposed in civilian shootings, and I think that's what we're seeing.
And we're not dying from IEDs. If we're getting our legs and arms blown partially off, then the tourniquet's the key there, not a chest dart or anything like that. And realistically, this was probably in the group some of the older data.
Yeah.
So there have been, unfortunately, quite a few more mass shootings since then.
Yep.
And I've not done a deep literature dive. I don't know if this paper has been repeated with the higher numbers. It would be something interesting to see if this, you know, could be corroborated. Unfortunately, we've got more numbers and more data, so I don't know the answer to that.
All right, another great podcast. Great job to Dr. Patrick for hanging in there. And that is there. I mean, that's a lot of information, right? And one thing that I want to say is, like, it's probably good that we've got tourniquets and we've got stop the bleed and we've, you know, but maybe we should be adding some stuff to stop the bleed or our individual first aid kits, right? Maybe we need to have chest seals. Maybe we need to have some, needle decompression stuff in there, because that honestly surprised me a little bit when I heard that discussion.
Yeah.
You know, on comparing sort of civilian wounds and military, and that not the samesies like we thought.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely something that we should be thinking about. Maybe expand out our stop the bleed and call it something else.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, the other paper that really struck me in terms of should we be doing something different was the paper looking at the motor component of GCS only compared to Total. Total has such poor inter-rater reliability and it's complicated. Maybe we should just say, is the person following commands and stick with that?
Well, it's interesting because, and not to belabor the point too much, but when you start looking at ramp triage, right, it's rapid assessment of mentation and pulse. So there again, the data was clearly showing that if they can follow directions in a triage situation, they're probably going to survive, right? If they're able to do the things you want them to do and they're compliant with that.
Yeah.
So we're starting to get into this thing where a lot of these pieces are starting to line up and a lot of them have to do with that, exactly that motor and mentation. So, well, we'll see.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, the lecture went on long enough, so why don't we punch out of here?
All right. Well, on behalf of Dr. Jeff Jarvis, Mike Verkest, you've been watching to and listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlyBridgeEd Podcast Network, and
a Fire Dog production.
We will see you guys on the next one. Take care.
Take care, y'all.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlyBridgeEd Podcast family, and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlyBridgeEd.com for more information.